You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello out there, Blogging Heads fans. This is Glenn Lowry at The Glenn Show at BloggingHeads.tv. And I have the pleasure of talking this morning with Lawrence Kotlikoff. You see there, just getting his clothing arranged. Larry is a professor of economics at Boston University. Larry is a very old friend of mine. A quarter century or more, we were colleagues at BU. In fact, he hired me back in the early 1990s when he was chairman of the department there, and we've been friends ever since. Indeed, I'm happy to report that Larry stood up for me as best man at my recent wedding that everybody in Blogging Heads land knows about because it happened exactly 1 month and 1 day ago, and I haven't stopped talking about it since. Thanks so much for coming out to Houston, Larry, and doing such a great job as best man at my wedding.
Well, Glenn, it was a fantastic wedding. You chose a fantastic wife, and she chose a fantastic husband. Juan's terrific, and it was one of the great honors of my life to stand up for you. And so it's fun. Everybody had just a marvelous time.
Well, yeah, it was a great time. You and your wife, Bridget, were a hit of the party out there, and you mastered of ceremonies at the reception so elegantly and eloquently. So, yeah, but enough about me. Larry, we're here because you are one of the country's leading experts in public finance, economics, and tax policy. You've written books, op-eds, research articles. You've been doing this your whole life. All the way back to the late 70s, early 80s. I can remember reading some of your pieces when you were at UCLA before the world discovered you. We are in the heat of a political legislative debate ongoing right now about tax policy in the country. The Republican House of Representatives is on the verge, I think, of passing a bill. The Senate will be considering it. President Trump has weighed in. A lot is riding for the Republicans on accomplishing something in this first year of the Trump administration, and it looks like with their failure on health care policy, that tax policy is where they're hoping to make their mark. It's being hotly debated. I've seen columns from some of our colleagues like Paul Krugman at the New York Times and Larry Summers weighing in critically of the Republican efforts. And I thought there's nobody better than you to help me and our viewing public understand What's at stake? What's in this bill that's being debated? What are the issues that we should be most concerned about? And what do you think about the criticisms that the Republican effort is sustaining now? So can you talk to us a little bit about that? I mean, first of all, can you just explain to me what's in the bill? What exactly is tax reform as Paul Ryan and his colleagues in the House of Representatives conceive it? And what do you think about the debate over the bill these days?
Okay, two different. Yeah. So the bill has a business side part and a personal side part. The business side part cuts the corporate tax rate from the official corporate tax rate from about 35% down to 20% at the federal level. If you look at the incentive for companies to invest in the U.S., it turns out that that's a very significant reduction in their tax on investing in the U.S. So when I simulate the tax bill, particularly this part of it, the increased investment incentive to invest in the U.S., I do find, and I think I've got the best simulation model that I co-developed with over 3 years with about seven other economists. It's called the Global Guidar model. And it's interesting. It's the same model that's used by the Tax Policy Center and the CBO and the Kent Smetters at Wharton and the Joint Tax Committee on Taxation. They're all using models that are descendants of the original model that I wrote with Alan Auerbach simulated, which is an overlapping generations model, which is a realistic model where people, are in different generations, they care for themselves, they save for retirement, they're not looking out for other generations, they're just out for themselves, and they consume and decide how much to work based on what the economy's incentives are, and
Perfect interruption, Larry. You were just describing your model with Alan Auerbach that you used to conduct analysis of proposed changes to tax law. Will you pick up where you left off?
Yeah, so basically all the models that I think are relevant for analyzing the impact on the U.S. economy are descendants of this initial Auerbach-Kotlikoff model, which simulates large-scale overlapping generations, what we call life cycle models, which are the most realistic models of the bread-and-butter model of economics, economic growth. So it's all the same type of model, except the version that I have, that I developed with colleagues over 3 years, seven economists working on it, is a model that incorporates the entire world. It's got all the countries in the world combined into 17 regions. And we're calibrating the model very closely to the UN demographic projections and also to the fiscal conditions in the different regions that are reported by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. So the demographics are incredibly important because we're adding two Chinas over the next 35 years. And that's going to, in terms of world population, where that population growth occurs is going to impact economic growth, it's going to impact global saving, and it's going to impact how much of that saving gets invested in the U.S. in response to the tax change.
And for a minute, excuse me, and I very much want to hear more about the model, but I just want people to understand that, and correct me if I say anything that you disagree with, the reason it's really important to have the right model, and you believe that you and Alan and your colleagues do, is that the effects of U.S. Tax policy changes are subtle and they interact with other economic processes that are going on a global scale. And one wants to take account of these knock-on consequences of changing our tax law if one wants to have an accurate assessment both of the implications for economic growth and for the fiscal, you know, sort of health of the U.S. Government's budget. So, you know, models are really critical. I mean, back of the envelope is just not going to cut it. And I gather you think, and this is what I want to ask you, whether or not the models that are being employed by the Congressional Budget Office or by the staffs of the relevant committees in the House of Representatives and the Senate or by the Council of Economic Advisors are up to the task of assessing the implications of the legislation that they're considering.
I don't think they're up to the tasks, basically, because I don't think they're not when you're dealing with an issue that really involves the response of the rest of the world to your policy, and you don't really model the rest of the world, you can't really you don't have a model that's actually up to snuff in terms of up to the job. Just think about what the foreign marginal taxes are on investing. What you know, why are people going to invest in the U.S. versus abroad if we cut our corporate tax rate, make it more, you know, economical to invest here? Well, it's going to depend on what those tax rates are abroad, right? And if you don't model the foreign the rest of the world, you won't know what the whole range of those tax rates are. They can range from 10% in some countries to 60% in these different regions. So getting that right, I don't understand how you can actually even study the issue unless you have the rest of the world explicitly modeled. That's point one. Point two is the personal side involves. So the big change on the business side is really lowering the corporate tax rate, and there's certain concerns about, is that just a giveaway to companies that are collecting monopoly rents,
right?
And that's something the model's not picking up as well as it might. So that's
that is your model is not picking up as well as it might the implications for the corporate.
Yeah, we don't have the kind of monopoly structure, and I'm not sure that it would be that easy to model that, because I don't know to what degree, for example, to what precise degree you would say that Apple is a monopoly versus you know, since this has some competition from some other companies. And whether they're colluding, and you know, in each industry, you'd have to really go into each industry and understand it's how competitive it is.
Again, excuse me, because most of our audience are not economists. The reason it's important to assess the competitiveness of the industries who will benefit from corporate tax rate reductions is that to the extent that they're competitive, the implications of those reductions are not to go into the profits of the corporation, but rather to go into the compensation to the workers at the corporation or to the benefit of consumers who buy the corporate products. Is that correct? I mean, that's what's at stake when you talk about monopoly versus competition.
What's at stake is more, you know, who's actually going to benefit, what Americans will benefit from this. But the incentive to invest here, even for a monopoly, will be much better. Apple has moved a lot of its operations abroad. They're headquartered. They're no longer a U.S. company, as far as I understand. They're an Irish company.
Right.
Their incentive to actually produce here in the U.S. and hire U.S. workers and raise wages is higher. So when I simulate the model, I find about a 12 to 20% increase in capital in the U.S. That's, you know, plant and equipment and residential structures and inventories.
As a result of the proposed changes in the Republican bill? Okay.
You're in question, and about a 5.5% typical increase in wages, real average household wages, during the path of the transition. So it's not an absolutely enormous improvement in well-being for U.S. workers, but it's something. Most U.S. workers haven't seen a 5.5% raise in decades.
And what are you saying about profits? What about the implications for shareholders' returns at these corporations?
So we're assuming that these corporations are competitive. We're not assuming monopoly in any of the markets, but that's something for future research. And that's something Paul Krugman has raised questions about, but he hasn't done any of the hard work for actually modeling this. Now, on the personal side, we have some kind of time-honored tax loopholes, like you and I get to deduct state income taxes because we're in states where we have a state income tax, and typically it's the blue states they're going to get hurt because that's where the state income taxes are the highest, and they go away, the deductibility of those go away in the new tax law. In addition, there's a limitation on deductibility of mortgage interest. I think property taxes, you're still allowed to deduct all of your property taxes. I forget whether there's a limit on that or not, but I just forget on how that works. So there's also getting rid of the exemptions, and there's a larger standard deduction, larger child tax credit. So there's a bunch of changes that they're getting rid of the alternative minimum tax. They want to get rid of the estate and gift tax. So lots of different things on the personal side. And then the question, and some are kind of pro-rich and some are pro-poor. So the question is, how does it all balance out? And I have a separate analysis that I've been doing on fiscal progressivity and spending inequality, and its implications for spending inequality, which is ultimately the bottom line. Ultimately, we as economists care about the distribution of spending, not the distribution of wealth or the distribution of labor income or the distribution of tax payments or transfer payments. Ultimately, we care about people's well-being and the distribution of that. You know, are some people much happier, better economically than others? And that ultimately comes down to what they get to spend. You could have, Glenn, for example, all the wealth in the world. And if your government takes it all away from you and leaves you in poverty, your spending will be zero. So even though in terms of wealth, you'll be the richest man in the world, in terms of spending, you'll be the poorest. So we have to look at this comprehensively in terms of the impact of the fiscal policy on spending. But ultimately, we want to look at the distribution of spending. Now, it turns out that you can do this. And the way you do this is you take data, and this is what I have done with Alan Auerbach, who's at Berkeley. We spent about 3 years building a model where we take the Survey of Consumer Finance data from the Federal Reserve. It's a nationwide 6,000 household survey, roughly that, calculates or collects data on income and wealth of different of these households and other demographic information. We run it through a program that we made that's based on my software company's primary tool, which does lifetime financial consumption smoothing. So we figure out for each survey of consumer finance household, how much will they get to spend every year the rest of their life, given the whole tax system. So we spend 3 years putting in all the we've got the federal and the state taxes and the Medicare Part B taxes, premiums, already in there, but we had to add food stamps and the corporate income taxes and the federal and the state level, TAFDC, the transitional aid to families with dependent children, that's the welfare system, Medicare, Medicaid. So we spent 3 years putting the entire fiscal system into this model, and then we figure out what happens to these survey consumer finance households under the current law versus under the new law. And we look at the distribution of life, of remaining lifetime spending, and we don't compare apples and oranges. We don't compare somebody who's 80, who's got, few years left to live and also, and makes them to do spending and also, has paid all their taxes in the past and are receiving transfers now with people that are 30 who are going to be paying taxes in the future. It doesn't make any sense. And that's what's Washington is just looking at current year taxes and comparing the old with the young, throwing everybody into one bucket. And that's completely ridiculous. It's really bizarre because, people don't pay taxes just for 1 year. They don't do spending. Get transfer benefits just in 1 year. They've got the whole future that has to be incorporated. So what we do is we look within a cohort, like a 10-year age group. And if you think about, let's say, 40-year-olds, we ask, okay, if you align the 40-year-olds from top to bottom, from those with the highest resources, and by resources, I mean their wealth, their net wealth, financial wealth, real estate wealth, plus the present value of their labor earnings. That's their human wealth. So we take their total resources, net wealth plus human wealth. We rank them from top to bottom. And we look at the top 1%, the ones who've got the households that account for the richest households who collectively account for 1% of the total cohort resources of all the resources of 40-year-olds. And then we look at the 5% percentile, the richest households that account for the top for 5% of the cohort's resources. And then we also look at quintiles. So for example, the poorest, the lowest quintile is the 20% of households, the poorest 20% of households ranked by resources that account for 20% of the total resources. Now, here's what we find out. Under the current law, the top 1%, they account for about 11.9% of total spending. They get to do the present value of their spending over their entire lifetime, not just this year, but the whole lifetime spending. If you look at it in present value and you incorporate all the different survival paths that they may take and you incorporate the estate taxes that they may end up paying, that they'll pay at the end of each survival path, you properly weight everything. This is a project that incorporates deals with the uncertainty of when households are going to die. So it's comprehensive in that manner. Anyway, you find that the top 1% have about 11.9% of the spending. And that's very unequal, but it's much less unequal than their holding of wealth. They have about 23% of the total wealth. So when you do this correctly, you see that inequality in spending is a whole lot less than inequality in wealth, which is what Piketty, I know you've talked about Piketty on your show.
Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, and I want to know the relevance of this to assessing
proposed
tax changes. Yeah.
Okay. So the top 1% have about 11.9%. The bottom 20% get to consume about 6.6% of the total spending. So 20% of the people at the bottom only get to do, they don't get to do 20% of the spending, they get to do 6.6%. And they only have about 1.2% of the wealth. So there's a lot of redistribution. The reason the rich don't get to spend, don't get to spend like their wealth is because, partly because the tax system's very progressive. And the poor get to spend more because the tax system's progressive. Now, if you go to the new law that's just been proposed, the distribution of spending is almost identical. If you draw a chart, of these numbers, the like 11.9% and the 6.6%, the spending shares, under the new law versus the old law, it's almost, you know, to the naked eye, you cannot see the differences. There are some minor differences, but they're small. So it just turns out that this, proposal, even though it does some things that some people like Larry Summers and Paul Krugman think are really, you know, pro-rich and some are, it turns out that when you do the analysis correctly, that this is not that different in terms of the distribution of spending. And we're also incorporating the assumption here that's really critical, that there's a 5.5% increase in wages, that there's a dynamic feedback effect associated with are having a much lower effective tax rate and capital flowing into the country and raising wages. So that has to be incorporated too. So the conventional analysis that on which these guys are basing their opinions is really quite bizarre and totally flawed as far as I can tell, because it's myopic. People are just assumed to live for 1 year. It compares apples and oranges, 80-year-olds with 40-year-olds, and it's static. It doesn't incorporate, as far as I know, any of the feedback of on the economy of, you know, of the proposal's impact on wages. Now, I need
Hold on. Before you go into something else, I want to hear a little bit more about this dynamic. Is this the dynamic scoring that I hear referred to with such derision by many on the left? The idea, is this supply-side economics that you're talking about when you say incorporating what you anticipate to be the growth in wages associated with relaxing corporate taxation and bringing more money back to the country? And right. Can you defend, you know, you're not Arthur Laffer, you're a serious economist. Is Arthur Laffer or that way of thinking about, you know, I heard from Paul Ryan and other Republicans, well, the CBO is going to get it wrong because they're not taking into account the dynamic growth effects, and so we're going to grow at more than 3% a year. We haven't grown that fast in so long and so forth. Where do you stand on all of that?
Okay, well, you know, a lot of these organizations, they have several different models, and they're averaging none of which I think is correct. So they're averaging like three wrong numbers. If, for example, the CBO, I think, has the Tax Policy Center has two or three models. CBO has two or three models. And then what they do is they take some average. None of those three models is, in my view, up to the job of studying this problem. And only one of them is a true life cycle model that's really appropriate for growth. And none of those and those life cycle models don't include the foreign sector. So you're averaging two wrong answers does not give you a right answer, or three wrong answers. That's so. As for Art Laffer and supply side responses, so the model that Al and I developed back in the late 70s, and we've just worked on it through the years together, apart, and other people around the world have done so, use the model, and that's why it's spread to these other agencies and think tanks. This is a model that doesn't have any crazy supply side parameterization or supply side responses. If you just cut personal taxes, this model will produce larger deficits and it will crowd out capital. If we're talking about a closed economy, and in an open economy, it'll produce deficits, may not affect the wages, may not be impacted through time much, but future taxes will be higher for our progeny because of the deficit. So this is not the kind of Art Laffer supply side model where you cut personal taxes and you get a good economic response. You get a bad economic response. But there's one area and one area alone where we showed starting in the early 80s that you could get a good supply side response, and that was in corporate tax reform. And what we have is a corporate tax rate, which from my understanding, based on calculations done by a Canadian tax expert named Jack Mintz, who's been working on this, on studying marginal effective corporate tax rates literally for decades. And I think he's got the best numbers. So there are other people with different numbers on, but he's got the most comprehensive numbers. And, you know, according to his numbers, basically we have a marginal effective tax rate around 35%, 34.6%. That's going to drop down to 18.6 under the tax reform. That's a huge drop. But the other key thing to realize is that the average tax rate right now that we're collecting under current law is about half of the marginal tax rate. So just think about that. Right there, think about raising the marginal tax rate to 100%. The average tax rate would go to zero because nobody would invest in our country, right? And then you'd be in a real laugher situation. It'd be obvious to anybody, including Larry Summers and Paul Krugman, that if you lower the marginal tax rate, you'll get more people to invest in the U.S. You'll actually get some revenue. Well, we're not exactly in the 100% zero, 100% marginal rate, 0% rate, but we're in that, we're in the realm, in the range of where you can get a laugher effect on the corporate side, because the average, the tax revenue from the corporate tax we've got is very low. We've got a high marginal rate, a very low average rate. And if you drop it from 34.6 down to about 18.6, you actually get enough impact on capital coming into the country, higher wages, to get enough extra personal revenue, personal income tax revenue, and some additional corporate tax revenue from the extra capital coming in, even at the lower rate, that the whole plan turns out to be about revenue neutral. So we're not showing deficits of any kind coming out of the analysis the way we do it. So you might say that, gee, this is a born-again Republican you're talking to.
Right.
But I don't do my economics based on anybody's politics. I don't. Yeah. And these models were developed years before Donald Trump ever decided to run for president.
Yeah.
So this is not – nor am I trying to get in a position in some administration that I think is – abhorrent in almost every dimension. The fact of the matter is that the Republican tax reform started out, half of that reform, the business part, was a proposal that Alan Auerbach put together, who's anything but a Republican. He's
right.
A Democrat.
Right.
Pretty much a lifetime Democrat. So when you looked at the original House Republican plan called the Better Way Plan, half of it was Alan's plan. And then the other half was some reasonable things to do on the personal side, nothing really crazy, trying to simplify. And then, it's not my plan. It's not exactly what I would do. I would, if you ask me what I would do, I would get rid of the corporate tax entirely. I'd get rid of the personal – let me just tell you 2 seconds. Get rid of the personal income tax. I'd have an inheritance tax. I'd get rid of the state and gift tax, but I'd have an inheritance tax, a carbon tax, a value-added tax, I get rid of the ceiling on the Social Security payroll tax, and I would have a cash flow consumption tax on the rich. So I would have a very different and much and more progressive tax system than we now have, and more pro-growth than they're even proposing, and also less redistributive in terms of transmission of wealth across generations to the rich. In real inheritance tax above $5 million bucks at a 20% rate really go after kids who are getting, huge endowments from having done nothing, just having been born lucky. So that's where my brain is in terms of that tax reform. But nobody asked me to redesign the tax reform.
Yeah, hold on a minute, Larry. And no, unfortunately, no one asked you. I want to just underscore a couple of things. One of them is here we have academically respected and influential economic analysis that is apolitical, coming from people who are, if anything, inclined toward Democrats. I speak of you and Alan Auerbach in particular, saying, as between the personal and the business components of the Republicans' proposed tax reform program, the business component, lowering the marginal tax rate on corporate earnings from the mid-30s to the high teens, would have positive and welcome implications for economic growth and for the wages of working people in the United States. And you're not saying that for some ideological back-of-the-napkin cut taxes and we'll get more growth magic. You're saying that from the hard numbers carefully worked over through a well-calibrated and vetted by peer review and so forth piece of economic analysis. I think that's worth underscoring. You're also saying, if I hear you right, that it's impossible to infer the inequality implications of tax reform from looking at a short-term or one-year kind of immediate incidents, who's going to gain and who's going to lose, and come out of that saying the rich are going to get you know, their pockets filled. It's a giveaway to the rich. If I hear you, you're saying to understand the inequality implications of tax reform, we need a carefully calibrated life cycle model that looks over the entire structure of taxation and that is oriented toward assessing what the implications for lifetime spending opportunities of individuals will be. And when looked at in that way, you find that the proposed Republican revision of the personal and business tax code are have relatively minor or negligible effects on the lifetime inequality of the opportunity to consume and spend in the American economy. Did I say anything inaccurate in that summation?
No, that was on target. You know, I do want to say that the spending increases, this basically raises this, it's not just the distribution of spending, but also the absolute level of spending that we care about. This will raise the living standards of from our calculation, basically all Americans. It'll disproportionately raise the living standards of the rich because they pay higher taxes. So it's going to increase their share of spending. The top 1%, for example, their share of spending goes from 11.9% and the 40-year-olds to 12.1%. That's a very small increase in their share of spending. But if you think about that percentage, you take their initial level of spending and you multiply it by a 0.02%, 2%, let's say, no, it's a 0.02% increase. It's a big absolute number. Compared to the absolute increase for poor people. And poor people's, so their spending goes up by about 2.5%, the bottom quintile. Other quintiles are more around 6%, 6-7%. The really poor people don't have a lot of labor income, to sustain their living standard. They're getting a lot of transfer payments compared to, labor income, and they're also not paying a lot of taxes, so they're not, you know, experiencing much in the way of tax cuts. So unless we do something more directly to help them or some other additional redistribution, like a fourth income tax bracket in this new law, although there is actually a hidden fourth tax bracket in this law, if you look at the details, if you go above $1 million, they start clawing back the fact that you pay taxes at a lower rate on your first amount of income up to $1 million. And so people actually are in a 46% tax bracket for about $200,000 range. So there is actually a short-term fourth tax bracket under this law. The other thing about, you know, why the rich aren't taking away the entire all the benefits from this new law is that the rich pay taxes, have disproportionate amounts of wealth. And if you take this lifetime perspective, you incorporate the fact that they're going to be paying taxes on their assets, asset income through time. And that matters a lot. It really is called double taxation, you know, among we economists, because when you earn money, you pay taxes at the time. But then if you save a portion of it and you invest it, you pay taxes on the income from the investments.
Right.
And that's the notion of double tax. And that gets captured in our analysis. We're also capturing the estate tax and the fact that it would go away under the new law. So we're trying to be you know, comprehensive. And I didn't know what the results would come out to be. I'm just reporting what I think the right model is producing. And
No, I want to ask you about the estate tax, because you made an ethical claim that I think some people would disagree with. And the claim was that the children who would inherit didn't do anything to earn it. They just happened to be lucky to have rich parents. And why do they have it coming? To which one kind of response, this is not necessarily my personal opinion, but I think it needs to be answered, would be, you're not taxing the children. You're taxing the person who's now dead. They worked, produced, earned, saved, and accumulated. They want to give the money to their children. It's their money. What am I missing here? They worked, they want to create a legacy for their children. Why are they not entitled to do that? What makes the state the default repository of a life's accumulation of assets? Because you don't want to bestow, if they don't want their kids to get an unearned windfall, they don't have to give it to them. It's their money.
Well, okay, here's two responses. One is that I'm proposing taxing inheritances above $5 million. So I'm not saying let's tax everybody's inheritance at a 20% rate, not at 100% rate.
May I just observe, Larry, that $5 million ain't what it used to be?
Yeah, I got you. But it's enough, you know, it's enough to keep you from having to sell your farm, the family farm.
Okay. If,
right?
Yeah.
I think. The other thing is a lot of people die. There's not a lot of strong evidence of altruism between parents and children that across the board in the U.S. You don't see parents, even rich parents, sharing a lot of resources with their kids. You got a lot of rich people and a lot of poor kids, and there's just not – it's not like one big happy family that's sharing the pot. So I think a lot of bequests that are happening are people – are nervous about spending down their wealth, or they have difficulty spending it, and then they just die because they've got too much of it. They can't really get, you know, and they haven't figured out what to do with it. They die at 70, at 80, thinking they'll live to 90, and then the kid gets the Maserati and drives around Boston University, where you see a lot of kids who are 18 years old driving around in Maseratis. But we also have a lot of poor kids here, so I don't want to give the wrong impression about my university. It's a,
right.
It's a first place, a lot of foreign kids too. So, but I don't see that we want that kind of concentration of wealth, which to my mind is coming largely for random reasons, not by design. It's not that that a billionaire spent his whole life making that $1 billion in order to leave it to his child, his sole child. You know, I don't think that was his motivation. I think his or her motivation was, I got onto some kind of gold mine. I'm figured out how to keep mining it. I get a lot of goodies from bragging with my buddies, flying around in my Learjet, going to golf tournaments with the president. And this is great fun. And now all of a sudden I've got cancer, I'm dying, who am I going to leave it to my kid? No. We got too many poor people in this country. And the country is broke. I mean, the other big problem with this tax bill is we need a whole lot more in revenue. So the idea that it breaks even is not good enough. We need to get more revenue. So I've been calling for lifting the ceiling on the Social Security payroll tax, for example, as an amendment to this bill to make it more progressive and to produce more revenue, because Social Security is 32% underfinanced. It's got a $34 trillion unfunded liability. This is compared to a $20 trillion official debt. So Social Security is this off-the-book debt just for Social Security is massive compared to our official debt. And then we got all these other off-the-book debts.
Why are you trying to raise my taxes, Larry? Because I'm one of those people whose taxes will go up a lot if we raise the cap on Social Security contributions. Why aren't you talking about reducing the benefits that Social Security pays out to wealthy recipients by mean testing some of them? Why isn't some of the cutting in the social programs on the spending side rather than solving the unfunded liability problem by raising my taxes?
My answer is that we need to do both. We need to actually have more taxes. We're relatively, compared to how we're spending on defense and other things and transfer payments to a lot of people that are middle class and upper income, as well as very poor, we're undertaxed as a country. The other thing is that we have a massive fiscal gap, something like $200 trillion. When you add all the off the book liabilities, net of the, if you take all the spending that the government projects to be doing, as projected by the Congressional Budget Office, and you subtract all the projected taxes, and you include in the spending, the servicing, the official debt, the $20 trillion official debt, you've got a $200 trillion fiscal gap. We're leaving that entire thing to our kids. So unless we take more from Glenn Lowry, Nehemiah and Glenn Jr. are going to face much higher tax rates. That's the problem. And that's the moral dilemma of the day, because our country is at war with our children, and we're at war on the fiscal front, on the climate front, I think in the nuclear proliferation front. I think the fact that we've done nothing so far except, we haven't been serious with North Korea in terms of stopping their production. All that is endangering our children. That's transferring risk to our kids.
I want the listeners to know that you are the author of a very fine book. Gosh, it's been 15 years now, hasn't it? The Coming Generational Storm, in which you detail, and I gather the case hasn't improved much since the publication of that book, you detail how it is that the long-term fiscal dilemmas that our country faces because of commitments that we've made to supply benefits to people, old age insurance, Medicare, and so on, has the implication that our children and our grandchildren are going to be in a tough pickle, because they're going to have to pick up the bill, and there's no way that they're going to be able to get the same kind of benefits in their own old age as we are promising to currently living, cohorts of older people. So people should know about that. The book is still worth reading, I think.
Yeah, we have Scott Burns and I wrote that. He's a longtime columnist with the Dallas Morning News. He's just recently retired, great guy. And we wrote a follow-up book called The Clash of Generations, which came out, kind of working off the title, A Clash of Civilizations.
I want to ask you one other thing, Larry. In conversations we've had previously, you've expressed concern about the implicit taxation on poor and relatively lower income people that are built into the way in which various kinds of social benefits, like, for example, in Obamacare, phase out subsidies as people's earnings get higher. They become right. ineligible for benefits. The effect is implicitly a taxation on their marginal dollar of earnings and a discouragement for them to work. Is there anything in the current debate that addresses itself to that concern? And if you had your way, what kinds of changes might you recommend to deal with the kind of hidden taxation of the means-tested social benefits?
Well, under the new proposed tax law, the effective marginal tax rates, the median effective marginal tax rates, drop by a few percentage points for the different quintile groups. For the richest people, they drop by the most, so that they have the largest additional incentive to work. But these things are still quite high, 30, 40, 50% marginal median rates. So that means that half the people are way up, above, to potentially way above those kinds of numbers. So we have a thoroughly screwed up tax system. This reform would make it somewhat better, but it would still end up, because it's just the federal part. We've got state taxes, we've got state sales taxes, food stamps. You earn an extra dollar, you lose 23 cents. For many people earning a tax credit, you can lose 22 cents on the dollar. Obamacare, the subsidies phased out as you earn more money. So there's a lot. You lose Medicaid. We have to fix all this stuff collectively, and the reform of the tax system is just part of a set of reforms I've written about in a book called You're Hired Rather Than You're Fired. You're Hired! Exclamation mark. It's on my website, kotlikoff.net. It's free for anybody to download. It's about 100 pages. And it will say in postcard length, here's what to do to fix Social Security. Here's how you fix healthcare. Here's how you fix banking. Here's how you fix taxes. And it's just, you know, based on not a lot of conversations with economists over the years and thinking about what's the simplest way in the case of the fiscal side to put everybody in a 30% bracket and no exceptions. And that's my design, my tax reform made sure that everybody was paying 30% at the margin, not more, not less, when you put together all the provisions of what I'm proposing. And they all fit again on a, at least the reform fits on a postcard.
So you think the simplification argument that Paul Ryan and other Republicans are making about the current proposal is a plus for them?
I think basically whoever in the House Ways and Means Committee started to design this bill started with a good design, and now they've screwed it up significantly, but it's still worth doing on balance right now as it is. They may make it so bad through the political process that it's not worth doing, but what we have now is worth a shot, worth doing on balance. It's not what I would propose. Not I would change it, but if it's this or nothing, let's go for it.
Okay, Larry, I'm going to let you have the last word on that. I want to mention that I got a number of requests at Twitter and Facebook. Get Kotlikoff back on to explain the tax debate to us. So I and they are glad that you found time to talk with us today, Larry. Thank you very much.
Great pleasure. See you soon, and give a big hug to Luan, okay?
All right. I'll tell her hello, and see you soon. Take care, my friend.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.